Today on Speaking Out of Place, I talk with Omar El-Akkad about his new book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. The title of the book comes from a tweet he posted 3 weeks after the bombardment of Gaza began. The tweet has been viewed now more than 10 million times. Horrified by what has transpired since that moment, Omar El-Akkad wrote a full-throated indictment of the principal concern of the modern American liberal. It is, quote, not what one does, or believes, or supports, or opposes, but what one is seen to be, end quote. Moving from the scale of the individual to that of entire industries and political parties, we talk about the terrible consequences of this attitude with regard to Palestine and beyond. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I have to tell you, when I first saw the title of your book, I was immediately reminded of something a friend of mine told me, who was an anti-apartheid activist in Berkeley in the 80s. And he said, nowadays, you can't go back to Berkeley without finding anyone who is not an anti-apartheid activist, when in fact, for the longest time, there were very few of us. So your title really rang a bell, as does this passage on page 117. You write, quote, it's difficult to live in this country at this moment and not come to the conclusion that the principal concern of the modern American liberal is, at all times, not what one does or believes or supports or opposes, but what one is seen to be, end quote. So before we get into specific cases, could you flesh out this idea a bit for us? Because it informs, I think, the entire book.
Yeah, I think that it's a book that sort of barges in through the door, pretending to be in desperate need of picking an argument or picking a fight with as many people as possible. And I get that, and I understand that response to it. Certainly that's coming. But to me, the book is much more about this sense of uncertainty that comes when a particular orientation you have, a particular way of aligning yourself in the world, proves to be personally untenable, but you don't know who you're going to become on the other side of that. And so when I write a passage like the one you just read, the principal subject of indictment is myself. For the past 40 years, for the vast majority of my life, I've been that person, right? I'm the person who picks up the ballot and looks at the person with the R next to their name and then votes for whoever has the D next to their name because they're the best chance. And it's good enough. And because I'm not a particularly courageous human being, it was good enough for a very long time, and I was rewarded for it. I think every human being has their sort of personal moral red line, and that's been crossed over the last year and a half, and it brings the whole thing tumbling down. I live in Portland, where it's the world capital of that sort of thing being good. It's, you have these neighborhoods where everybody has the Black Lives Matter lawn sign, and you're in a neighborhood that's overwhelmingly white because they built the highway through the black neighborhood and displaced all the black folks. And so I think the most insidious thing about that particular sort of mindset is that most of the time when you're in the heart of the empire, when you're on the launching side of the missiles, it's good enough. There's no consequences for being that kind of human being. It just so happens that in the last year and a half, it hasn't been for me. And so I've become unanchored from something that I've oriented myself towards for the vast majority of my life. And I honestly don't know who I am on the other side of that.
Yeah. Now, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because you punctuate the book with your going to that awards ceremony and the sort of exactly the meditation that you just set before us. And also, as you were speaking, I was thinking that a few weeks ago, I had Peter Beinart on the show about his recent book, which is also about this decisive moment that has come into both of your lives in terms of taking a position. And you've both been doing it for a long time, but there's something decisive about the way that you position yourself now. So could you tell us something about Gaza? Why and how did this make such a difference to you?
I think three things come to mind: immediacy, intimacy, and complicity, if I had to round it up. As soon as you open your mouth about a subject like this, the inevitable counter is, why don't you care about Sudan? And why don't you care about the Congo? And it's fascinating to me because it's usually a criticism lobbed by people who absolutely do not care about Sudan or anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not this amazing gotcha of hypocrisy. It's more an indicator of a worldview in which apparently one can only care about a single individual issue at any given time, and also that partisanship is implied at all times. Whose side are you on? Whose team are you on? But the immediacy of it, I think, the immediacy and the intimacy of waking up every day and just seeing documentary evidence of the worst things human beings can do to one another. People have their breaking points in their lives, the moments that sort of change them, and everybody has their version of that. And for me, it was listening to audio of a little girl begging for her life before she was murdered in her car. And I'm not trying to convince anyone of anything. However you react to that is your business. And if your immediate reaction is, oh, by focusing on that, you're ignoring the suffering of Israeli children, or you're ignoring what's that's the kind of human being you are. And I'm not going to change that. I have no interest in trying to change that. Yeah. That's your worldview. But for me, it was too immediate and too close. And you multiply that by thousands upon thousands, to the point where, and I say this as a huge coward, I've effectively stopped using social media. I've stopped being in that world. And that is an immense abdication of moral responsibility, right? I should be witnessing. And God knows in many other ways I am.
Mm-hmm.
But then the third thing about complicity, right? I'm killing those kids. My tax dollars are doing that, right? And it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And I apologize for rambling, but the moment you try to not be that person, the moment you try to say anything about it or do anything about it, you are endlessly a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't an isolated moment in time or place. This is a function of the system we live in. I was invited recently to this literary festival. And I agreed because that's what you do. And then I find out that the literary festival is sponsored by a weapons maker.
Yeah.
And now I'm in the process of being the difficult guy, and that's going to happen. It's everywhere. And I think that your options in that kind of situation are a self-imposed obliviousness, or you try to do something and take the implicit cost that you will be endlessly a hypocrite, that you will be impotent to change anything, that maybe nothing will come of this, but maybe the ruining of your career or something like that. But those stakes, relatively speaking, feel very different after the last year and a half.
A few things. One is the title of the podcast is Speaking Out of Place. So there is no such thing as rambling. That's precisely why I wanted you on the show and others on. And second is the rhetorical weapons folks use against people speaking out are multifarious. And few people know this, but before the American Studies Association endorsed the BDS call, a year before, the first academic organization to do was a tiny little organization called the Association of Asian American Studies. And remarkably, members of Congress started attacking us, not because we were powerful and influential, but we had done it. And the first line of attack is, what would Asian Americans know about Palestine? And we said, A, we've learned a lot, and B, the Philippines, Hawaii, all Vietnam, Korea. This is a litany of colonial endeavors and invasions. Yes, we find resonance, and so we're learning what this might mean. But I really appreciate the number of scales from small, personal, intimate to immense that your book takes on to make its case, because you're showing a pervasive mentality that in individuals may have a personal effect, but when transmitted into large institutions, it becomes fatal. And you show the immensity of what we might call selectively applied liberal conscience applied to a case of genocide that we've seen unfold since October 7th, 23, which has its roots, of course, in a project of ethnic cleansing that stretches back at least 76 years now. I'd like us, if you're willing, to move through a few of these groups and ask you to show how the duplicity takes place and results in perpetuating one way or another the mass killings of Palestinians. So first, you have a scathing indictment of the idea of lesser of two evils, the Democratic Party in the United States. So how does not only their rhetoric, but also their actions allow this violence? And I was really struck by the point that you made that, at least with MAGA Republicans, you know where they're coming from. It's straight on. They believe in what they believe in. They're not going to hedge. They're not going to obfuscate. They're not going to feign one thing and do another. So tell us a little bit about your observations of how the Democratic Party reflects this mentality.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring up that criticism that the association faced about what do Asian Americans know about Palestine, because to me, it's so incredibly telling of the experiential gap. And what I mean by that is the book launches this week in North America, but it launched a couple of weeks earlier in the UK and Ireland. And I was in Dublin doing an event. And afterwards, I'm at the book signing table and this guy comes over, this big stocky dude, and he just looks angry. He looks pissed off. And I'm like, all right, here we go. And he comes over and he's not really interested in the book or in me or anything. And rightly so, it's not. But he comes over and he says, we will never stop fighting for Palestine because it's in our DNA. And then he shakes my hand and he slams his fist on the table and marches off.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying everyone in Ireland is standing up for it. I'm not getting that. But I think that you have either been made to experience something like colonialism or you have been freed from experiencing the receiving end of colonialism. And so when someone says something like that, when those folks in Congress attack the association saying, you don't know, look, there's no limit to what I don't know. Mm. I don't know the vast majority of things, but I don't think this is about what I don't know. It's about what you have had the privilege of never having to know.
Wow.
And so I think of it in those terms, and I think this relates to your question, which is this notion that there's a lesser evil. Obviously, in a binary party system, which the United States effectively is at the highest administrative levels, there's always going to be a lesser evil. And that lesser evil, unless something drastically changes, is always going to be the Democratic Party. I understand that conceptually. I've been made to understand that, right? I understand what Republicans are doing and what they plan to do. My sense of it is that this can't be your orientation as a political party, to tether yourself to the worst possible thing and then say, we're better than that, therefore give us your votes. Because you as a politician or as a political entity might be able to operate in a relative mode endlessly, but human beings aren't like that.
Yeah.
We have our moral thresholds. And once you cross them, mm-hmm. I simply can't endorse you because I'm not a pragmatic actor. I'm not a cold, calculated political operative. I'm a human being. And if I've seen a party which had the power to put mass slaughter to an end not do that and instead cheerlead and finance it, I have passed a certain threshold where the idea of lesser evils make no sense to me. And I understand how much rage that inspires, because right now we're in the middle of what appears to be an openly fascist administration. And even though I'm pretty sure that if all the people who abstained from voting for Harris over the issue of Palestine voted for her, I don't think it would have made a difference. But who knows? Maybe. I think consequence is a two-way street. It can't be just on me for making this happen. Perhaps at some point, even a minor bit of self-reflection on the part of one of the two most powerful political parties on planet Earth is due. Because we don't get here, I think, if there isn't such a massive chasm between what a political entity presents itself as and what it actively does, and its belief that it can cross that chasm simply by saying, but hey, we're the lesser of two evils.
Yeah. During the campaign, I kept on having exactly these debates with my friends and saying, because the guilt would be flowing my way, saying, you should feel guilty for not. I said, why don't they do something that signals in a meaningful way that they care? Because if they don't, it shows that right now they're failing Palestine, but they are able to fail anything, right? It's in their DNA, as you say, to be able to legitimize any kind of abhorrent behavior by saying, but it's better than that. And that, how far have we sunk before we start to fight back about that? You also talk about other nation states and how they fall in line with Israel and the bravery of the South Africans bringing the case to the ICJ and then the response of the West. Could you talk a little bit about, because a lot of your work from Guantanamo on was talking about human rights and the international human rights community. What's your sense of how this operates on a more global scale?
Yeah, I think for me, I have a very specific relationship, or I suppose non-relationship, with the idea of the nation state just by virtue of the kind of life I've had. Mm-hmm. I often say that I've been a guest on someone else's land ever since I was 5 years old,
yeah.
To the point where whenever I'm introduced anywhere, the bio could read Egyptian-Canadian, American, American-Canadian, some permutation. There's people who think I'm Qatari because I lived there for 11 years. You have a much more diaphanous relationship with the idea that a nation state is sacred, I think, than if I had just been born in Ohio, grew up in Ohio. So I don't begrudge anyone for that kind of patriotism. And to be honest, there's a lot of days I wake up and wish I was that person, because I think the institutional support network, when you are that kind of person, is robust. There is a particularly insecure part of me that wants some days to be the kind of person who gets up and puts their hand on their heart at the football game when the planes fly overhead and all the rest of that. And I don't begrudge anyone who does that. I just haven't had that kind of life. What has been fascinating for me to watch, particularly over the last year and a half, is the disconnect between the compelling forces of in the nation state arena versus what the people who live in those nation states actually want and demand.
Yep.
Like this book, I often, in the interviews I've done, I've said, I don't think it's going to be remembered. But if it is remembered, I think it's going to be remembered as one of the tamest examples of its kind. The amount of anger that I see when I travel outside the confines of an area where the news environment and the political environment and the social environment tempers all of this. When you go to somewhere where that's not the case, people are furious because they've been watching hospitals get bombed and they've watched kids be sniped for sport, and they don't have to worry about how it's going to affect their social or political careers to be outraged about it. And yet, in many cases, certainly in the part of the world that I come from, once you reach the governing level in the nation state, there are cold, pragmatic concerns that come into play. You look at these UN votes on Israel, and the vast majority of Greens, the vast majority of support, yes, and then there's maybe one or two abstentions, and then there's a couple of against. There's a couple of no's, there's a few no's. And it's the US and Israel, and depending on which party's running Canada or what moment we're in, whatever. And then there's a bunch of island nations that clearly have absolutely no interest one way or the other.
There's eight. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think for me, it's difficult because I am one of those naive human beings who does try to look at this through a human lens. But the thing I'm looking at is so deeply unhuman, deeply of a different kind of makeup entirely, which is what makes situations like what South Africa did, or Ireland's government's position, for example, with all the flaws inherent in that. But what makes it so rare, but I don't think that it's out of line with what human beings in these states are actually feeling.
Perhaps closest to home, you have a very trenchant critique of your own profession, the press, and public writing in general. And I'm wondering, do you remember or know of the case of Emily Wilder? Did you follow that? So Emily was a undergraduate here at Stanford, and she was a part of Jewish Voice for Peace, etc. And she tweeted a couple of things about Sheldon Adelson. Fine. A couple of years after she graduated, the College Republicans picked up these tweets and started to feed it into the right-wing blogosphere. And it got the attention of Senator Tom Cotton. And this is right after the AP building was bombed. And so the AP was very sensitive to this. And they fired her. And she called me.
Yes, yeah.
So she was a student of mine. She calls me. She said, David, I'm working for the AP, but my beat is shopping malls in Phoenix, Arizona. The idea of press neutrality is bizarre, but she stepped forward. And I think 200 AP reporters signed a petition defending her. So there's a great passage that begins on page 100, and it says, in truth, I have no idea what the work really is. And I was really struck by that in particular. So I'm wondering if you could read as much of that passage as you would like, and then begin some discussion that elaborates your thoughts at that moment.
I don't know what this work is anymore. I read piece after lengthy, erudite piece about the need for a nuanced, both sides discussion of a genocide, about how words are so easily weaponized, and we must be very careful because weapons can hurt, as all the while very real weapons raise entire Palestinian neighborhoods and their occupants. A magazine decides to pull a milquetoast essay that reads like an Israeli settler colonial homage to the Blind Side, and writers line up to condemn the existential threat this kind of censorship represents to the future of literature itself. Fine. What does the killing of hundreds of Palestinian novelists, poets, and journalists mean for the future of literature? I read an op-ed in which a writer argues that the model for Palestinian-Israeli coexistence is something like Canada's present-day relationship with the indigenous population, and I marvel at the casual, obvious, but unstated corollary that there is an indigenous population being colonized, but that we should let this unpleasantness run its course so we can arrive at true justice in the form of land acknowledgments at every Tel Aviv poetry reading.
So, can you talk more about that? Maybe tell us a little bit about how you got into writing in the first place and then what you're finding now.
Yeah, I got into writing because it's the only thing that's ever pulled me in. I'm no good at most things, and I quit easily. And writing is one of the few things that even when it kicks my ass, I go back to it. And so I knew from a very young age, from 5 or 6, that all I wanted to do was write stories. But of course, if you come from a particular kind of immigrant background, you know that you don't become a writer, you don't become a poet or a musician, you become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. And so my degree is actually in computer science. I'm useless at it. I can't program my way out of a paper bag. But at the university, I spent all my time at the student newspaper because, again, it was an avenue to write. And writing is how I make sense of the world. It's also how I retreat from the world, which is certainly what this book is. It's a lot of me being essentially unable to function in the world as it is, seeing what I was seeing. And so I sit with it on the page, and I'm no more capable of functioning after I've done the writing, but at least I've sat with it for a while. Journalism was something I fell into after college because there was no way I was getting a job at Google or something. That was never going to happen. And I got lucky and got an internship at the big paper in Canada, the Globe and Mail. And it's the only real job I've ever had. I spent the next 10 years there. And it was my education in the world. It was my education in writing. When you've had deeply unsentimental back desk editors slash your copy for 10 years, it really helps with someone whose prose is as purple as mine. So it was my education. It was the education I didn't get in college, essentially. The sort of overarching thing that comes to mind when I think about the profession now in light of the last year and a half is, again, another example of the sort of chasm between two things. The chasm between the story as the journalist would have written and reported it in a vacuum with no external pressures, and the story as it was written under very real conditions with those pressures in place. And I think good journalism essentially obliterates that gap. And I think most journalists are good, and most journalists are doing the work as their conscience tells them to do it in relation to the facts, in relation to the situation as it exists in human terms. And then you get into something like Palestine, and all of a sudden that gap is massive. And conceptually, I understand that, right? There was a foreign correspondent at my old newspaper who told me that there was a reader who would take every one of his stories and count the number of times he said Israel or Israeli and the number of times he said Palestine or Palestinian. And if there was any mismatch, would write a letter to the editor saying, you have an anti-Israel reporter on this issue. How dare you think? It's pointless to try and pretend like these pressures don't affect people and don't affect institutions. We are human beings. We don't want to get yelled at. We don't want to lose access. We don't want to lose our jobs. The paper doesn't want to lose advertising. There's a million external pressures at any given moment. But I've seen firsthand, I mean, I reported on terrorism cases in which, you know, those people and their families were not able to sue. They were not able to really fight back in any way. And you were left to your own devices. You could write the story in a vacuum. You could write the story absent external pressures. There is a profile of a Canadian billionaire that ran decades before I showed up at the paper that you can't find anymore. It has been wiped. And the reason it's been wiped is because that guy had the means to fight back. And so you see these external pressures all the time. I'm just not sure in my lifetime I've seen them just as glaring in under a free press as I have this last year and a half.
You also talk about instances that give you hope. And I had just yesterday, I think, Leila Lalami on her new great novel, The Dream Hotel. And we ended talking about hope. And I said, these days, I think hope is too big ticket an item for me. I'm just trying to live every day in the best way possible because so much shit is happening all the time. And she was talking about that was some of the reason why she wrote the novel. Nobody can take your dreams from you. And you end your book talking a little bit about instances that give you hope. You don't have to use that word if you don't want, but help you get through a day, maybe. What kinds of things are you seeing that let you get from day to day?
I've been thinking about this a lot because as depressing as it is to say this is the most hopeful book I've ever written, I do think of it as a profoundly hopeful book,
yep.
Not in the sense that I'm a profound person or that the writing is profound, but that in the sense that it's so easy to not be that. Mm-hmm. And I don't begrudge anyone who is broken by this. And I think that I have become broken by this. Like you talk about this idea of there's so much shit going on, that has consequences, right? One of those consequences is that you don't get to properly grieve. I was teaching at Georgetown's Qatar campus in November, and this Palestinian kid walked in. I mean, I say kid because he's half my age, a young man, obviously, but he walks in because I'm the writer in residence for a month, and he just wants to meet and chat. And of course, I ask him, how are you doing? And he says something to the extent of, my father's family made it, but my mother's family's gone. And then 20 minutes after that interaction, I have to go give a craft talk. And you think to yourself, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
This is meaningless, all of this, right? Everything. And it's very easy to get there and stay there, get to that place and stay in that place. But honestly, one of the bizarre upsides of living through this moment is that I am a giant coward. And so I'm constantly leeching courage from people I've never met, probably will never meet, people I have met, people I'm close to, because in this situation where if a tiny fraction of any of this horror happened to the people who live one town down the road from where I am in Oregon, this country would come to a standstill.
Yeah.
Because those lives actually mean something and aren't worth the empire's schematic. You have to derive that and use it to keep you from being debilitated. Yeah. And I keep coming back to the same examples. These kids in the schools who are dealing with tear gas and dealing with arrests and dealing with their administration that's supposed to protect them, trying to destroy their lives and their careers. And yet they're out there doing the work. The people chaining themselves to the gates of weapons manufacturers, the dock workers refusing to load the missiles onto ships. I've done nothing. I've done the bare minimum as a writer. I did some writing. But what gives me hope is that, first of all, there is a resource that is available to these human beings who are working individually and working in solidarity with one another that is quite simply not available to the state institutions that are responsible for this carnage. And that resource is love. It's compassion. Mm-hmm. It's giving a shit about other human beings.
No.
And that is an area of asymmetric engagement. The people have the advantage. Compassion, joy, non-involvement.
Mm-hmm.
These are areas in which the people have the advantage. So that gives me hope. Another thing that doesn't quite give me hope, but at least allows me to go on,
mm-hmm.
is that I am desperate for the endorsement or adoration of people I respect. I found that I actually quite enjoy the antagonism of people I don't respect. And when FreedomEagle1776 at hotmail.com sends a racist tweet your way, yeah, I want everybody to love me and all the rest of that, and that's great. But I can think of few things worse than becoming the kind of person that kind of person likes.
Yeah.
And so that helps a little as well.
Since I'm way older than you, it used to be the Nixon's enemy list that got people. But I have to tell you, you probably already know this, that I was very active in the Modern Language Association, bringing forth a BDS resolution in 15, 16 or so. And they voted it down. I said, I did a hell of a lot of work, but no, I'm not going to do it again. And then Gaza happened. And I thought, with all this happening, all the evidentiary base that we present to the association back then, A, has been vindicated and confirmed, and B, added to enormously by Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, ICJ, etc. How can the MLA not move the needle forward? And they went backwards. They wouldn't even let it be discussed in a meaningful way. And so I said, screw it. I'm just walking away. And then I hadn't read your book. I just saw the title of the book. It was just the title. I hadn't read the tweet because I'd gotten off Twitter. But the title of the book, just as I said at the beginning of this conversation, everything clicked in place. You're a very modest person, but it was catalytic. And so I wrote that long second resignation letter because it gave me, it just was so powerful, Omar. It really put things into perspective in such an enormously concise way that I want to convey that to you. Maybe the last question, and then of course we can talk about anything you want, but I know your time is precious. If you'll allow me, I think it's important for our listeners to know how personal this book is. And you end the book talking about this horrible illness that your daughter suffered through, and she's fine now, thank God. But I realize then you bookend the book with two young girls, one Palestinian and the other your daughter. And when I saw that, I thought a lot of what the book has shown us is how people are prevaricating or obfuscating or denying or whatever based on what people think of them. But how can we not invest in the children, whether they're ours or other people's, the future? How can we have our egos so precious to us that we can't put whatever people think about us aside and think about the future? I think that's part of your book, but could you talk a little bit more about it, perhaps?
Yeah, this, like I said, this book launched a few weeks earlier in the UK and Ireland. And so that was my first experience of doing media. And it's like being a stand-up comedian. You have this bit in your head that you're working out. And at the beginning of the year, it's awful and makes no sense and nobody's laughing. And then you hone it. And by the end of the year, you have the makings of a special because it's so polished. And people generally we don't like to talk about this as writers because you're supposed to be spontaneous and think about the question. But most writers I know have their answers in their back pocket. By the third month of the book tour, you've done the same question so many times. But of course, I don't have any of that when I go do this. And I found that I was getting not the exact same question over and over again, but variants of the same question, which basically boiled down to something like, oh, you don't want these people to be slaughtered? Who do you want to see slaughtered? And in some cases, I think it was just a shitty journalist, to be honest with you. But in some cases, I think people firmly believe that notion. I had an interview with a guy who was a committed Zionist, and virtually every question boiled down to something like that. Mm-hmm. And I can't distance myself from that worldview because I need to try to understand it, because I think it's indicative of an immense imaginative poverty. You know, the example I go back to is, it's a worldview in which you are either wearing the boot or you're having your neck stepped on. And the second you ask someone to lift their foot up, in their mind, you are asking them to trade places.
Yeah.
There's this thing Baldwin said about the most insidious thing. I'm paraphrasing here. Please, to your listeners, look it up because I'm doing a horrible job with what was a very eloquent point. But that the most insidious thing that racism does to the white mind is essentially say, no matter how wretched your condition is, at least you're not black. And it creates this binary, right? It creates this binary where the second I say, I would rather burn everything down than see another child hurt, let alone murdered by the tens of thousands. As soon as I say that, I think there's a particular kind of worldview that thinks, oh, you naive, useful idiot, you want someone else's children then to die. Yeah. That must be where you stand on this. And I think that is such a self-evidently destructive place to be.
Yeah.
Ideologically, morally, but even just pragmatically. Mm-hmm. If anybody thinks that the last year and a half has done something to diminish recruitment, the worst kinds of violence imaginable, they're out of their fucking minds, right? So even at a pragmatic level, it seems that the least we can do is everything in our power to make sure that we're not living in the kind of world where you and I are sitting around talking about the mass slaughter of children as though it's this inevitable kind of consequences of the world we've built. Fuck it, then we should tear this entire world down.
No, exactly. And I've had that sentiment nearly every day, especially being a professor of the humanities. It blows my mind to think that it wouldn't be self-evident that it's not a matter of one person's child versus another. It's our humanity. How do we reach this place where we could be blasé about it and capitulate to the world as is which goes against everything that we, especially professors of humanities, are supposed to stand for. Thank you so much. I really am not saying this just to make you feel better about the effectiveness of your book. It's an incredible book. It really is both unscathing toward the institutions and the mentalities that allow us to continue business as usual. But as I said, you're very honest about your own weaknesses and your own moments of doubt. And I think that helped me a lot because I have them. And in terms of leaning on people's courage, I'm leaning on yours a lot, Omar. So thank you so much for being on the show.
The feeling is absolutely mutual. This has been a privilege. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.